There have been recent news stories about an invasive species of carp, voracious, multiplying at a fast clip, that's posing a tremendous threat to the ecosystem of the Great Lakes. But as it turns out, that's not all that unusual. Interloper species, dangerous to the environments they have entered, have cropped up all over the world for quite a long time. So today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about just what makes a species invasive and a serious problem as a result. And joining me now are Thomas Grotus, Assistant Research Professor at the Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences at Rutgers University, Jessica R. Kate Schuller, Manager of the Forest at the New York Botanical Gardens, and Robert Nazzi, Curator of North American Botany at New York Botanical Gardens. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Let's begin with you, Jessica. Is there an accepted definition of what an invasive species is?
Yes, there is. Actually, President Clinton signed an executive order on the definition of invasive species, and it has started all of that research and hype that's been going on in the last decade or so. And an invasive species is a species that is alien or non-native. It has been introduced by humans into a particular area, and it causes harm, whether it's economic, environmental, or human health.
So, and what kinds of species are we talking about? Is this everything from bacteria and viruses to insects, plants, animals, everything?
Yes, everything.
Tom, does an invasive species always have to be introduced by humans, or can something migrate naturally to a new location and still be invasive?
Well, I think as in reflected by what Jessica said, the term invasive really has been reserved for one that is introduced by some action of people. Having said that, there's been migrations and what we call dispersal events or colonization events of animals into new territories or new environments for long before there were people on the planet, and certainly continuing after that, and that's considered natural.
Can we say humans are an invasive species when they enter a pristine environment?
I don't really think so. I think that dispersal is a specific trait of humans, a great ability to disperse is part of that.
Well, we sure can cause environmental harm, can't we?
We can, but we are also part of the environment. So it's, that's a value judgment, really. I don't think that it is defined ecologically, though.
Robert, you were laughing at that.
Well, I know a lot of people that would accuse us of being invasive, and we certainly have a lot of the tendencies, because one of the things that marks an invasive species is that it's aggressive. It's inherently aggressive. So, for example, in terms of invasive plants, they grow quickly, they produce an immense crop of fruits, and in the process can rapidly invade communities, natural communities and human-dominated communities.
Well, when we say aggressive and when we say something causes problems on economic level, aren't we making value judgments there as well?
Absolutely. Especially with former President Clinton's executive order, the focus was on economic harm. And being humans, we look at the world through our lens, and we're interested most often in our own concerns. But that's why we're studying this.
Can, Jessica, can a species stop being an invasive species and start being considered a native species in time? I'm thinking black locusts, which were brought by the first settlers. They are now considered to be, I guess, part of the natural environment.
Yeah, they are definitely, and they for black locusts, we do say the black locust is naturalized.
Because they no longer present any kind of danger?
No, they do. They do. They do. They present danger to threat of biodiversity and just the overall impacts that a native species does. I mean, it does invade and threaten native communities. But what I want to go back to is the definition of native and the consensus of native plant people or the native plant community people. We talk about native plants being native to the United States prior to European colonization, and mm-hmm. that's what we focus on. So the Europeans actually brought black locusts over.
But we also brought over cows
right.
and pigs
right.
and goats and
right.
sheep.
Right, which are not native.
And we brought over turkeys thinking that they weren't native either. It turns mm-hmm. out we were bringing turkeys back to the Americas.
Well, Leonard, one of the key things here about invasive species is that they invade natural communities. And the harm that they cause to the environment is often greater than the economic harm. So that's the real key here, because we can talk about weeds growing along the roadside, and as long as they're restricted to the roadside and don't invade or enter into natural communities, then they're merely weeds.
Tom, we've heard a fair amount about the carp and the threat that they pose to the Great Lakes system. They're from Asia?
Yes, there's four species that are collectively referred to as Asian carp that have been problematic. And the worst of these, perhaps, is the silver carp, but also the big head carp, black carp, and grass carp.
Now, why aren't they problems in Asia?
Well, that gets to the heart of why a species is invasive. In a native place, animals evolve under the pressure of that native environment, which we call abiotic factors or abiotic stressors, but also under stress from the things that are evolving with them, the other animals, which we call, or plants, which we call biotic factors. And together we say they're co-evolving. And when you remove something from an environment, or let's say not remove it, but move it to another environment, there is a pressure release on it sometimes. There's many other potential invaders that we never see invading anything. We don't see them at all because they don't make it. And in the case where you have a successful invasion, it's because this release of either a biotic stressor or more likely an abiotic stressor lets them expand rapidly and really colonize a new area very quickly. And it's that quickness that we call aggressive. So in Asia, they've evolved under the conditions of their predators. And we have to think of their predators also in the evolutionary sense. We can't say what's there right now that's preying on them. There are things that may have exercised great control over them in evolutionary history that made them what they are that are gone now. An example might be crocodilians. But any number of other fish species that eat them when they're young or eat their eggs.
That are not present in the Great Lakes.
Right.
My guess are...
Well, we understand there's evidence that they're in the Great Lakes, but that's not conclusive. It comes from DNA evidence.
My guests are Thomas M. Grotus, Assistant Research Professor at the Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences at Rutgers University, Jessica Arcade Schuller, the Manager of the Forest at the New York Botanical Garden, and Robert Naxey, Curator of North American Botany at the New York Botanical Garden. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. This is Please Explain. We're talking about invasive species, and we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Jessica, I was thinking when we were talking about why in one place and not another, of something that almost destroyed the wine industry of Europe in the 19th century, phylloxera, which comes from eastern North America. Some grapes were brought into England, and the next thing you knew, the wine grapes all over Europe were dying off in great quantities because there's this little insect that destroys the vines. And the way that the Europeans took care of it was they brought a North American rootstock
mm-hmm.
to
right.
Europe because it was immune.
Right, Vitis vinifera, our native our native grape. Yes, it is. It's
But that was the way they dealt with it.
Yeah.
In some cases, we're not as lucky. It could really have just destroyed all of the grapes of Europe, couldn't it?
Yeah, it could have, absolutely.
Australia has a problem with cane toads. Are you aware of those?
Yes, and we have problems with them even in North America, especially in the southern part of the country. But, Leonard, you've highlighted something that's really key here, and that is the whole aspect of biological control. And that is, if we can figure out a natural predator or a natural enemy of an invasive species, we can use it to our advantage as long as we're careful that that predator or enemy is very specific to that invasive species.
Wasn't that a problem with the cane toads? They were brought in to control
Absolutely.
Something else, and then they wound up
they went
being
loose.
The problem.
Yes, yeah. You're right.
Well, in some cases, remember when killer bees, I throw this out to all of you, when killer bees became a major concern, we don't hear much about them. What happened? Did they start breeding with more passive breed types and get calmed down? Or was it that we just wouldn't allow them across the border from Mexico into Texas because the vigilantes were there preventing people from crossing the Rio Grande?
Well, they've made it here. They're in southern United States. But one thing about some invasives is eventually they reach an equilibrium with the environment. Now, some people may wonder, well, isn't that true of all invasives? Not necessarily so, because as Tom mentioned, there's a very complex interplay between the environment and the species that are present in that particular environment. So we can have hopes, but that's not always the case.
Tom, electric fences have been put in place to keep these Asian carp from migrating into the lakes. Do you see any promise in that?
Well, they work in tested situations. It's hard to say. Only time can tell on something like that. You see that carp are repelled by these barriers, but nature just continues to surprise us all the time, and I just don't see that it's a permanent solution. Something will probably get through those gates. We've seen it in the past, so it can't be a long-term thing.
Jessica, you and Robert have brought some sample plants, examples of something that would be considered particularly invasive. You have this a stick there, Robert, which looks pretty nasty because it's got all the thorns on it. What is that?
This is the Japanese Aralia tree, also known by a close relative here in this region as Devil's Walking Stick, because this is a stick that is just heavily armed with stout prickles all over it. It's quite formidable. And
I wouldn't want to put my hand on it.
Absolutely not. And this species, this Asian species, was introduced to the immediate area. It's present in New York City and surroundings for its beauty. And this is part of the problem, especially with invasive plants, is we bring them in for gardening. They're spectacular when they're in bloom, but we've found that they enter our local forests, where they compete with native vegetation, actually displace them and disrupt many of the natural systems in our ecosystems.
Wasn't there another tree that was brought in from Japan that wound up being the equivalent of a weed? I grew up with it all over Brooklyn.
Yeah, Tree of Heaven, Ailanthus altissima, yes.
And Ailanthus seems to have been finally checked. Has it become now something like a native species, or am I just not noticing it popping up all over the place?
Well, actually, Tree of Heaven, we found, has come susceptible to a fungus called verticillium wilt. And so in that scenario, there is sort of a native pathogen that naturally occurs here that's keeping that species in check, but it still grows. We still see it growing out of concrete.
In many of these cases, we brought them, but Tom, we move all over the world. And stuff attaches itself to us, to the vehicles we travel in. Is it possible to even prevent this sort of thing from happening?
Well, you bring up a point. I mean, we're not the only ones that move these things. Ducks certainly move spores and seeds and animals in their feathers from pond to pond. So you see dispersal similar to the way that we disperse things. We happen to be a lot better at it. We also have better means of controlling that when we need to, and we're still learning about that. I mean, you saw a lot of invasions in the past. There are still lots and lots of invasions going on. Some are being caught, but that's despite more travel, of course, an increase in the amount of travel. So we're beginning to understand the problem. There's still a lot of research that needs to be done with it. There's also a different tact, and this is actually a place where the plant and fish kind of discussion interact here, and that's in dealing with an example called Phragmites australis, or common reed. The common reed is an invasive, an invasive type. We have had common reed in the United States for a long time as a freshwater variety, and with introductions of genotypes from Europe that cross with this, it's become invasive and moved into salt marshes of the United States, where typically the salt would keep it out. And it's really, really changed the landscape here of marshes and affected fish communities in those marshes, where it has grown and dominated. And
it chokes out all other plants in the area?
Well, for a while, and then itself gets choked out by things like Tree of Heaven and other things, because it actually changes the marsh to the point where other things can colonize the soil that it has created, because it actually raises the salt marsh surface. And in doing so, it removes fish habitat, like pools and stuff. So, you know, there's been a struggle to try to contain this, or eradicate it, I should say, and that struggle has moved towards one of containment, where you live with it, and in a lower quantity, it's not all as bad as you might imagine it would be. It actually continues to serve as functioning habitat for a number of different things, from native insects through things as big as black bears. And deer and many birds use Phragmites habitat, as long as it doesn't reach a critical threshold where there is not enough of the natural vegetation and pooling left on a salt marsh to sustain a healthy fish population. So you can change from a complete eradication and elimination kind of strategy to one of containment at a percent where you get high levels of return for your investment, rather than trying to throw money down a hole. So that's just another way of dealing with it. It's still best if you can catch these things when they come in. But as you mentioned, and as I think everybody knows, things get through.
Mm-hmm. We will continue this conversation and take our calls from listeners at 212-433-9692. Also, deal with the comments that are left on our show page at WNYC as we continue this conversation with Thomas M. Grotus, Jessica R. Kate Schuller, and Robert Noxey. We're talking about invasive species on today's Please Explain. We're back with Jessica Arcade Schuller and Robert Noxey of the New York Botanical Garden, and Thomas M. Grotus of Rutgers University. We're talking about invasive species, and we are taking calls from listeners at 212-433-9692. A listener wants to know about kudzu. Jessica, was that an invasive species?
Yes, it is an invasive species. It first has taken over the south of southern United States and is working its way north. We actually do have some populations of it here in New York. But
we're seeing kudzu in New York?
Yes, it's here.
I thought it needed heat.
No, it has heat and has enough heat in our hot summers, but our winters keep it in check. At least right now they are, uh-huh. And so they're not spreading. It doesn't spread as rapidly as it does in Georgia.
Well, it's been around a long time, and I throw this out to all of you. When an invasive species has been around for a while and we know what it does, can't we figure out how to stop it in the same way that we go after diseases?
In some cases, we can, and we have strategies for managing them that have been in place for a while. But I want to follow up with what Jessica was just talking about with kudzu to answer your question, Leonard, because kudzu is a species that demands a high light environment. It stays on the edges of forests. It does blanket the trees, but on the edge. Here in New York, we have a much more serious threat, and that is one of amur honeysuckle, a species from eastern China. And it will grow in the sun. It will also grow in the shade. It leafs out very early and casts shade on our native spring ephemerals, these herbs that grow up and capitalize on the narrow window of opportunity when the trees have not yet leafed out in our forests. And so the research is ongoing, like what we do at the New York Botanical Garden, to study the effects of these invasives. But one of the problems is it looks like our native flora is disappearing. So we have had this species with us only within the last 2-3 decades in an invasive way. So we have not yet learned, to fully answer your question, we have not fully learned how to manage it.
And it's not just a matter of plants that are invading. We have beetles, for example, that attack the plants that we have.
Yes.
Where do they come from?
Well, right now, New York City is battling Asian longhorn beetle. This is a very serious insect that bores through maples and willows.
And it doesn't do that in Asia?
Yes, it does. It does do that in Asia. We right now are just trying to confine it in early identification, scouting. Everybody really makes a difference. If you have a tree in your yard and you don't know what's going on and it looks different than it did the day before, call somebody. Call your local extension office. Call the DEC. But early detection is key, and that's what we found, at least with Asian longhorn beetles so far in New York City.
Let's take some calls. Karen from Edison, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm sorry. One quick question and then another.
Just one quick question.
Kevin Lane tree, is that also known as a Chinese elm? And the other question was the snakefish in the Potomac and its mm-hmm. tributaries. What do you know about
that? Well, let's deal with the snakefish because we're going to try to limit everybody to one question. Tom?
Yeah, the snakefish or snakehead specifically is an Asian introduction, probably released from an aquarium owner, did breed very fast. Whole ponds were poisoned, and I don't know what the current status of that. There was a very aggressive campaign to eradicate that fish. It could potentially move over, like, flooded meadows between ponds and stuff, but generally, because it's a pond thing, rather than in a river system, As I understand, they had it under control, and things develop so fast on that. I could be wrong about that.
Well, let's get back to that the Japanese beetle. That's something that was just brought in by accident.
Yes, it came in cargo.
Because this other
shipping containers.
This other thing was dumped into water. I mean that was a human actually causing that situation, although I'm sure nobody realized that it was going to lead to the kind of problems it did. But in other cases, they just attach to a shipping container or something, and we have no way of knowing that we're importing these invasive species?
These were inside the wood. Yeah, and one big problem with these, especially these wood-boring beetles or other insects, is the transportation of firewood. And people will cut down a tree, an ash tree out in Wisconsin, say, and bring it across state lines, and they could be bringing another pest, which is called emerald ash borer.
Well, we should burn that wood as quickly as possible,
or
shouldn't we?
Or just burn it right there where you cut it down. Don't transport it.
Go ahead.
You highlight a good point, and that is some introductions are accidental, but many are on purpose. So we mentioned kudzu before. That was on purpose for stabilizing banks, for erosion control. Sometimes
a big mistake.
A big mistake, we later found out. We mentioned the Japanese Aralia that was brought in for gardening purposes. And there's another example, and that is the autumn olive was brought in by our Soil Conservation Service, which became, which was then part of the USDA, and it's changed its name. But they brought it in for wildlife value, and we realized, again, a big mistake all too late.
Well, what happens when we bring, let's say, wolves into an area that where there are no wolves? Would we call that an invasive species?
Well, you've got to realize that wolves were present over most of North America way back when, including New York.
But, Tom, in some cases, the kinds of wolves we bring in are not the ones that lived in those areas. Or we've been bringing deer to some islands that where there haven't been deer. Are we making a mistake when we do those sorts of things?
They haven't been there for, well, wolves, for example, and I think maybe another example is cougars trying to reestablish panthers, Florida panthers, by using cougars from the other states that are of a different genetic variety. But those animals have and reestablish a functional role in the ecology, or a complementary role in the ecology to the one that was removed, and it's actually established an existence of that animal is already established, in the sense that the community that it's being reestablished into has already evolved in its presence. You have to remember that these things, we have to look at the response of these things in evolutionary time, which in some cases extends before people's influence and even before people's presence on the planet.
Because we took them away and now we're putting them back.
Right. And in the meantime, yes, the community might have changed substantially, but there are elements of it which are accepting of the presence of this animal and controlling of the presence of that animal or plant back into that community, because they evolved with it in its presence.
Emily from Westchester, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. We have a lot of Norway maples in our neighborhood in Briarcliff. It's a neighborhood that was built about in the 1950s and 60s, and I guess the developers just put them there. And so how do you balance the good that they do by breathing in CO2 and giving us oxygen with the bad that they do by dropping all these seedlings? They are such invasive trees. Every little seedling, every little seed pod that drops becomes a little seedling, and they're really crowding out native species.
Well, Emily, I first want to sort of go back in history and talk about invasive species and how Norway maples came about, because if we look back in time to the streets of America before the 1950s or so, our streets were covered in American elms, and an invasive pest or fungus was brought in, and it was introduced, and it was called the Dutch elm disease, which wiped out all of our street trees. And to quickly replace them, we selected Norway maple, among other things, but predominantly Norway maple, to plant in our streets. And then we found that they were invasive, and it's a balancing line between your species selection, more research, and going forward with adaptive management, realizing that we made a bad choice, but it was the best choice we could have made at the time, and now we have to go, and we realize that they're invasive, and we just have to weed them out, and when we
There's
can...
no way to find, to know before they start proliferating? Is that
yes,
it?
there is, and there are people who are doing great research. Botanical gardens are wonderful resources who study plants within their collections and see how they act first before being introduced.
We have a comment on our show page from Jason in Manhattan. He says, the house centipede, Scutigera coleoptrata, is a terrifying thing to see, but I've noticed that predator's appearance in my Harlem house has eliminated nearly all other insects, such as cockroaches, ants, spiders, etc. Aren't these insects native to Mediterranean lands, not the Americas? And should I welcome them or try eliminating them, Tom?
I don't know about those ones. mountain entomologists where they come from.
Well, but what we're talking about here, and maybe Robert knows, we introduce something that seems to be doing something good, and then we have to wonder whether it's too good.
Biological control.
Well, the other thing is there are a number of species that are called synanthropic. That means they live in association with humans, and the house centipede is one of them. So that's not an invasive species. It doesn't leave our houses. It doesn't leave our urban environments and get loose out in the natural world and wreak havoc.
Anita from the Upper West Side wants to know if genetic modifications and genetic engineering are a form of invasive species. I'd like all of your opinions on that, Tom.
Well, it doesn't fit the species definition, which is fairly well defined, perhaps more so in animals than in plants, but it does change them and cause invasiveness. And I think that an excellent example of an accidental genetic modification is that of the one that I mentioned earlier for Phragmites. And yes, it was very much invasive when this European haplotype was able to establish and crossbreed with the native haplotype and really changed the landscape as a result.
I also have another example, which has been affecting our native mulberry, Morris rubra. Morris alba, or the white mulberry, was introduced and is interbreeding, and I think Rob has done quite a bit of research on this and studying the genetic pollution,
absolutely.
I guess we could
say. That's exactly a genetic pollution or genetic swamping. When we bring in these non-native organisms to the area, often they're pre-adapted to our climates because they come from similar climates elsewhere. And they often have close relatives nearby for that reason, because they're pre-adapted and previous dispersals have close relatives. Well, when they get here, they can, through their aggressiveness, dominate the landscape. They're more frequent, and they contribute more genes to the native population. And so doing, they swamp out those native genes. And then it becomes difficult, if not impossible, to actually find the native ones.
George from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Let me have it.
George, go ahead.
Hello.
Yes. George, you're on the air. Could you? We have very little time.
Yeah, sure. What does the carp have that is a natural enemy elsewhere, and can that be introduced into the Great Lakes?
Tom, I guess that we should ask you that. And I would add to that question, can we be sure if we bring a natural predator in that we won't just be introducing another invasive species and causing another kind of problem?
Absolutely. I mean, that has happened. It really, really should be cautioned against, especially when you're talking about predators, because predators, unlike some very highly specialized plant pathogens or insects that are very specialized to plants, predators, especially vertebrate predators, usually have a capacity to switch prey pretty easily. And some great examples are when rats were accidentally introduced to Hawaii and really caused problems there, they introduced the mongoose to try to control rats, but the mongoose were active during the day instead of hunting rats, which were active at night. They started eating the native bird eggs and birds and caused a problem there themselves. And are now invasive there. So that's something. So to go to the first part of your question, I don't know exactly what it is that keeps silver carp in check in Asia. There's a number of piscivorous fishes, meaning fishes that eat other fishes, like catfishes, in Asia, but it may also be environmental controls.
Well, we're out of time, unfortunately, okay. And I never even got a chance to ask you about climate change and how that's going to affect all of this, but maybe we could do a follow-up. This is such an interesting topic, and my great thanks to all of you for being with us, Thomas M. Grotus of Rutgers University, Jessica Arcade Schuller, and Robert Noxey of the New York Botanical Garden. It's been a real pleasure talking with all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.